Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and we will keep covering the developments in Boston this hour as the news warrants, and we will just we will talk about other things as well, so we don't just repeat what you already know ad nauseum, like some cable channels that you may be able to think of. But there are things happening, and I want to talk a little bit more right now about the details of the backgrounds of the two brothers, the one who has been killed and the one who is presumably the subject of the manhunt right now as they are emerging. The Associated Press is reporting in the last few minutes that the Boston Marathon bombing suspect who was killed overnight had studied accounting as a part-time community college student. Bunker Hill Community College officials say that the 26-year-old Tamerlan Chernayev was a student there for three semesters, fall 2006, spring 2007, and fall 2008. Patricia Brady, a spokeswoman for the school, said they had little information on him other than they had studied accounting at the Boston School. The other one, and I'm pulling this back up, the Associated Press is reporting, and forgive me, I'm trying to get this copy back in front of me, but that he was a medical student at the University of Massachusetts at Dartmouth, UMass Dartmouth. So with that as a starting point, with us now two guests from the International Crisis Group, a private NGO that studies and tries to prevent deadly conflict. Paul Quinn Judge is head of their Asia program and is very familiar with Chechnya. And Daniel Pinkston, a North Korea expert with the International Crisis Group. They both happen to be in New York today on ICG Business. So thank you very much for coming to our studios.
Great to be here.
And Paul, we are reluctant to jump to conclusions just because these brothers are said to be immigrants from Chechnya, and there are conflicting reports today as to whether they came in the last year or whether they came more like 10 years ago. They're 19 and 21 years old. But then again, there is a history of Chechen terrorism in pursuit of independence from Russia. They also come from an area that is described by the AP today as having some Islamist insurgency elements there. So does it make sense to you that this could either be linked to Chechen separatism or be linked to Al-Qaeda?
It's impossible to talk about Al-Qaeda right now. What is clear, these are young Chechen males who've been probably brought up with the historical memory of liberation struggles and now a jihadist struggle in the North Caucasus against Russian domination. Their background, we don't know too much about the background, but it's certain things are fairly clear. They do seem to have lived here for a number of years, according to the Russian language social media sites they were on. But they have almost certainly been brought up with the memory of at least their family talking about the destruction of Grozny, the capital of Chechnya, in 2000. The struggles for liberation or autonomy before that. And they have also, they're the generation that has been very much radicalized religiously. It used to be a struggle for autonomy in Chechnya and other parts of Southern Caucasus. Now it's viewed as part of the international jihad for creation of a caliphate. They've had all these influences and all these memories forming their short lives.
The suspects of from a place that the AP characterizes as near Chechnya. Have you seen the actual town name and are familiar with the actual location?
No, what we're seeing right now is that they are ethnic Chechens. They may have been born in Chechnya, but they live for some while in Dagestan, which is a neighboring North Caucasus state republic. part of the Russian Federation, also with a strong and very abiding history of resisting Russian rule, and more recently one that has been extremely radicalized in a Salafite way, i.e. the Wahhabis, as we tend to say. They've rejected the old Islamic traditions of the North Caucasus, which were Sufi, and somewhat more all-embracing and somewhat less radical in worldview and demands of their own people. And they also lived, we're told, in Kyrgyzstan in Central Asia, an independent Central Asian republic that was part of the Soviet Union, or another republic, Kazakhstan, which is next door. If they did live there, they probably did so because they had relatives who had been deported by Stalin in 1944. So there's another element that goes into making, I think, their historical worldview.
And so when people looked at the images that the FBI released last night of the suspects before we knew who they were and said, oh, look, they look Caucasian. Well, they're not just white. They're actually Caucasian.
They are real Caucasian, yeah.
But you're saying from an area of Chechnya that has been quite radicalized and in a religious way. Because I think also when some people think about Chechnya, they just think about a sort of territorial dispute or a Russian domination dispute, or even maybe think about the Muslims from the Balkans, from Bosnia in the 1990s, European Muslims who maybe you wouldn't think of as culturally or, let's say, with religious politics that would be similar to some of the people in Pakistan or Saudi Arabia, for example.
The Chechens have been fighting for autonomy or for independence from Russia for, to put it conservatively, 150 years. It's an ongoing struggle. The Chechens, in fact, in the past, when one traveled around Chechnya, the parallels that you'd find many politically active Chechens, many people who are supporting the autonomy movement, the parallel that they would tend to draw would be Ireland and the struggle of the Irish against the British, a small nation fighting a larger colonial oppressor. In the last 10 years approximately, the old guard of the Chechen resistance in the North Caucasus movements for independence has been replaced by a much younger group of people who see themselves very much within the worldview of the international jihadist struggle. From what we can guess from both the background of these young men and the stuff that's on the social sites in Russian, they felt pretty comfortable with this. And the chances are that they were radicalized not by a concrete movement, Al-Qaeda or anything else. They were radicalized by what they saw on the web, what they've been reading for the past 10 years in various languages on the web about the Islamic struggle. And again, it's another example of the way the jihadist movement in North Caucasus, like elsewhere, is no longer a single strong, coherent movement. It's a mix of people with the same religious worldview and the same desire for revenge against Russians or the other perceived oppressors.
We're told that there's going to be a news conference in Boston starting momentarily. I just want to make sure that Daniel Pinkston gets in at least a word, because you were scheduled for the show today anyway to talk about North Korea on your trip to New York. And one of the developments in recent days there is word from U.S. officials about how developed the nuclear technology is. Like, do they have missiles that can reach certain distances? Do they have nuclear weapons that could be used with those missiles? What's your best understanding?
Well, there's a lot of unknowns as far as their nuclear capability. We do know that they've allocated a lot of resources to this program for decades. They've conducted 3 nuclear tests. I think at least in short range or intermediate range, they do have missiles that probably could deliver nuclear warheads. They can't deliver a nuclear warhead at long ranges to the U.S., but that doesn't mean we should be complacent or not worry about it. There are a number of challenges and security challenges. They could sell this stuff. They've cooperated with others. So we face a lot of potential challenges from North Korea.
Well, on complacency, we've had several reports that for all the heated rhetoric, South Koreans are pretty complacent themselves and not concerned that some kind of attack on them is imminent. What do you think?
Yes, I think in the past month or two, We've seen a lot of rhetoric that was mostly couched in the context of deterrence. Nevertheless, I think North Korea is engaged in a coercive bargaining game. They're trying to get the world to acquiesce to a new status quo they're trying to establish with North Korea as a nuclear weapon state. They want to see sanctions lifted. They want to see UN Security Council resolutions rescinded. And when they bolster their nuclear deterrent in the future, as they say, they want the world to accept this. They believe this is their sovereign right. And I think they're going to continue to challenge the international community, make everyone feel uncomfortable until we accept this.
When some Americans ask, well, what do we really care if North Korea, or for that matter, Iran, gets nuclear weapons? They would never attack anybody with them because then the international community would come and destroy their regime. The answer I usually get is the real concern is that they would share this material with terrorists. And so as we talk about Boston today and, you know, people can conjure up any worst-case scenarios for potential terrorist attacks, is that the main concern or a main concern with respect to North Korea, in your opinion?
Well, that's certainly one of the concerns. There's an academic literature on this subject. I would argue that the more states or organizations that have these weapons, it increases the likelihood, even if it's a very, very small possibility, it would have catastrophic results. So we're talking about human beings, complex organizations, and sometimes they fail. So if there's a misperception or escalation, or if a regime sees itself doomed and going down, they might want to use these weapons. They could be transferred to other organizations or, as you suggested, possibly terrorist organizations. So
either through some of their materials leaking out or because they actually make a deal with a terrorist organization, which is not a state, and so they wouldn't suffer the same ramifications if the state's fingerprints are not found on it.
That's correct. And there are a number of barriers to concluding those transactions. Again, I don't think it's likely. But North Korea has a number of state clients. They've cooperated with Iran. And the more states that get these or groups or what have you, the more nuclear weapons that are around the world, the more likely it is that one could be used.
Is there, Paul Quinn Judge, a Chechen community in the United States to speak of, a big immigrant community in Boston that these suspects are a part of, or anywhere else?
No, to the best of my knowledge, there isn't. There are large Chechen diasporas in various parts of Europe and in Turkey and more historically in Jordan, but very few here. And the few comments we see on the social websites by these two kids, by Jahar Tsarnaev and his brother, suggests that they were pretty much, even though they were incorporated very much in schooling and stuff here, they felt themselves at something of a distance from American society.
How are you picking that up?
They have some stuff on Russian social media. One place which is the equivalent of Facebook, I guess, called ВКонтакте. And let's see, Jahar Tsarnaev has some comments about his background, as do his brothers.
Oh, these are things that they themselves have posted in
the past. They have posted, which are very very vanilla, very low-key. But one remark, Tamerlan says he was a boxer, a heavyweight boxer, and he really was hoping to become a member of the U.S. Olympic boxing team. And he said he would, unless Chechnya becomes independent, he would prefer to fight for the U.S. and for Russia. He also notes, though, I think, that, yes, from the site, he notes that he doesn't have many American friends. So, again, he's a little at one side.
Though described as a second-year medical student in the United States by his father.
Yes, one is I haven't seen here there isn't a reference to medical student, but that's probably, you know, just
– right. And this is the Associated Press quoting his father in apparently a telephone interview from Russia with the Associated Press.
Yeah.
And, of course, the extreme gruesome irony of somebody who's studying the healing arts – conducting an act of terrorism, but does it surprise you in any way that somebody who was becoming very educated as whatever might also wind up committing an act like this?
15 years ago in Chechnya, the anti-Russian movement had some intellectuals and some former military officers, but mostly they were village kids. Now they are becoming more and more educated. These are people with tertiary education who are being radicalized by reading Russian or English or French or whatever websites. The world is changing, and the movement is becoming much more sophisticated.
So, listeners, to give you just a little bit of behind-the-scenes procedure and how we wound up with these two guests in our studio, we had been told by the International Crisis Group that Daniel Pinkston, a North Korea expert, would be in town today, and we jumped at the opportunity to have him in our studio. Then when all of the details started emerging about the Chechenian background of these Boston Marathon bombing suspects, we said, well, maybe this is not the day to talk about North Korea. And the International Crisis Group said, well, along with Daniel Pinkston in New York is Paul Quinn Judge, whose voice you were hearing, head of their Asia program, who is very, very familiar with Chechnya, as we've been hearing. So they are both here, and we're having this kind of back and forth on two different situations until the news conference, which we expect to start very, very soon in Boston. So back to North Korea. Talk about the population there. How horrible is it to be a North Korean under this regime? And is a North Korean spring in the realm of possibility?
Well, I visited Pyongyang last summer, and I had not been there in 5 years, and it was noticeably improved as far as the standard of living. There had been a lot of construction, a lot of new vehicles. People seemed to be dressed well, a lot of mobile phones. There were a lot more restaurants. Stores were stocked and so forth. So things had improved in Pyongyang, but I also had a chance to go out to the countryside. And in the countryside, it looks like things have not changed much since the 1960s. So there's a huge gap in the standard of living, and that could be a source of social instability in the future. The state has chronic food insecurity problems. They're not able to feed themselves. So they, when there's a shortage in supply, they triage. And, of course, those who are viewed as less loyal to the regime, they're the ones that go without food and other resources. So Pyongyang, the capital city, kind of showcase city, things look like they're going along pretty well. But you get out into the countryside, and then it's a different story. Those that are along the Chinese border are able to trade and barter and so forth. So things are a little bit better there. But many of those in the countryside who do not have those opportunities actually are doing quite poorly.
Would a lot of people in Pyongyang actually support Kim Jong-un if they were given the choice?
Well, there are the loyalists in Pyongyang. They have a stake in maintaining the system. There's no civil society. It has been completely eradicated. I don't see the possibility of bottom-up revolution like we've seen in the Middle East, at least for a long time. The security apparatus and the repression is very, very well entrenched and developed. So I think if there is some instability, it could come very sudden in the form of a coup or assassination attempt or something like that. It's a very, very stable dictatorship, but dictatorships are stable until they are not.
When you say there's no civil society, what does that mean is not there?
Well, when I study or read for comparative purposes, East Germany, for example, people talk about the totalitarian nature of former East Germany. But in East Germany, there was a church, there was an arts movement, there were writers and poets and so forth. People had access to foreign media. In North Korea, all of that has been eradicated. People laugh about the former leader Kim Jong-il's interest in movies and the arts and so forth, which he began his career in the 1960s. But it was actually a very well-designed program to co-opt and control all of the arts. So whether it's performing arts, music, movies, and so forth, nothing is allowed to go on without control of the state. So whether it's sports, religion, anything, the state is entrenched down to the family level. And so as far as taking any collective action, people do not have any kind of social networks or ability to take action.
Okay. So I thank you both.